Tourists are obnoxious, unless you're one of them. We all want adventure, but every adventure happens in someone else's backyard. Hawaii knows this better than any place. In this episode, what I learned from my travels in Hawaii about how we can visit paradise without paving it, and what we owe the places we visit. It's iHeart Hawaii on iHeart This. I'm Ben Lord. Let's talk about what we love. I never really wanted to go to Hawaii. Don't get me wrong, traveling there has been one of the most stimulating adventures of my life. But I really didn't expect it to be. Now, already, just two sentences into this episode, some of you are probably shaking your head like, dude, what's wrong with you? Hawaii, this is the trip that people dream of their whole lives. But hear me out. When I thought of Hawaii, I thought of languid beach resorts where your bags are delivered to your hotel room, and sunburned tourists sprawled on beaches and paid to watch people dance around in coconut bras. That might sound fine to somebody else, but I've never been a sit-in-the-beach, sipping-a-brightly-colored drink kind of guy. Since I was young, when I dreamed of travel, I dreamed of pilgrimage. Seeing Mongolia on horseback, or mountain climbing in darkest Peru, or backpacking in Zambia, I felt a kind of disdain for vacation packages and postcards and checking off the sites in a Lonely Planet guide, because I didn't want to buy the idea of a place for the price of a luau. I wanted to be in the authentic heart of a place itself. I wanted to be a human being and not a customer, a traveler and not a tourist. The fact that I ended up in Hawaii was lucky happenstance. The fact that I ended up in Hawaii was almost happenstance. My family and I got an invitation to visit our good friend Jamie at her home in Honolulu. She offered for my wife, two kids, and I to stay with her for nearly a month in her apartment. We would have a free place to stay, an ancient Volvo to borrow whenever we wanted, and a kitchen to cook in. The offer was so generous that we could hardly turn it down, and that's how we ended up in Hawaii for not just one, but two long stays over two different summers, even though I had never really wanted to go. When we accepted, I told myself that going to tourist land didn't mean that I had to get on the Mai Tai train. It didn't have to mean postcards and package tours. I could hop off the tourist circuit whenever I wanted and set off to find the real Hawaii. But that is not what this episode is about. This episode is about how Hawaii blew so many of my notions about what travel was out of the water. Chapter 1. Freedom and Entitlement. Hawaii is no stranger to entitled guests. It's been getting them at least since a pair of British ships under the command of James Cook arrived in January of 1778. Cook arrived toward the end of the four-month-long feast of Makahiki, a time of rest with a ritual prohibition against warfare. And this may explain why Cook wasn't immediately sent packing by the Hawaiians when he began dismantling the wood surrounding a heiau, a temple and burying ground, presumably to make repairs to his storm-damaged vessel. As you might imagine, when he returned some weeks later, after Makahiki was over, the Hawaiians were less than happy about his return. When he tried what amounted to the kidnapping of a local aristocrat, or ali'i, tensions rose, and Cook ended up face down on the beach with a knife in his back as the surviving members of his crew fled back to their vessels. In short, travelers have been overstaying their welcome for centuries. Over the 19th century, the Kamehameha dynasty consolidated power over all the inhabited islands of Hawaii. They embraced the newfound technologies of their overseas neighbors and became Victorian aristocrats with an opulent palace and diplomatic relations and ambassadors around the world. As part of this exchange with the world beyond the sea, they leased land to Westerners, mostly Americans, who wanted to start sugar plantations, and sugar changed the face of Hawaii as it has done to so many other places. The plantations imported workers from around the Pacific Rim for their labor, and the sugar industry dominated the Hawaiian economy. Instead of a system of land ownership, Hawaii originally operated under a system of collaborative land stewardship, Each island was organized into wedge-shaped watersheds that radiated out from the central mountains. The responsibility, kuleana, for management of those resources was divided between the various classes of Hawaiian society. It was a system called malama aina, and the foreign sugar plantation lessees didn't like it because they didn't own the land from which they were earning vast sums of money. And over the course of the 19th century, they used subterfuge, threats, and violence to secure that ownership and disenfranchise the Hawaiians, their alii, and their monarchs. You can still visit the Iolani Palace today in Honolulu, the last home of the Hawaiian monarchs. Queen Liliuokalani, the last queen of Hawaii, was living there when she was deposed by a group of American businessmen who, with a kind of Orwellian flourish, called themselves the Committee of Safety. With the backing of U.S. military troops, they overthrew the sovereign government of Hawaii in 1893 and immediately began working for annexation by the United States, which they secured in 1898. While not really a tourist destination during its years as a U.S. territory, Hawaii was host to the U.S. military, which appropriated large swaths of land across the islands. Most famously, this includes the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor, but there are a dozen bases spread across the islands who have not exactly been good stewards of that land. Driving along the saddle road from Kona to Hilo in the Big Island, you pass signs which tell you it is dangerous to leave your vehicle because of the unexploded munitions in the lava fields. What we think of as tourists began to arrive around the time of Hawaiian statehood in 1959 when air travel became widely available. So today, the resorts and hotels that buy up oceanside property and the people in them who complain about traffic and parking are just the latest in a long history of visitors who seem to think they own the place. We ended up in Hawaii just after it opened to tourists in the summer of 2021. And Hawaii was bursting at the seams with visitors. The strain on the locals was palpable. Imagine this. During the pandemic, for the first time in living memory, local Hawaiians had had the beaches and trails and streets and waterfalls to themselves. For most of the people I know, lockdown felt stifling. But as one Hawaiian told me, the pandemic had made him feel free. Now, he said, all you people come back and it's too much. Too much. Then he seemed to remember that I was one of the you people and quickly added, no offense. And certainly I didn't take any, but I couldn't help but think of my place in Hawaii differently after that. When I was a kid, my hero was the American naturalist John Muir, whose travel plans were said to have been nothing more than to throw a loaf of bread and a pound of tea in an old sack and jump over the back fence. And my best days in Hawaii were ones just like that, where I picked a direction and ran along whatever road or trail I could find. One day on Kauai, I chased a group of wild chickens along the top of seaside cliffs for almost a mile before they realized they could turn off the trail into the brush. And later that day, I wandered down into the Makuahi Cave, a limestone sinkhole on what I thought was a completely volcanic island. The nearby road was closed, so there was no one around except me and the chickens. On the way back, I watched people take daring leaps from the cliffs over Shipwrecked Beach. There were wonders around every corner. On days like that, I felt an expansive sense of freedom, like I could go anywhere. But as the it's all too much, no offense guy made me realize, the line between freedom and entitlement is a blurry one. Just my being somewhere changes what that somewhere is like. It is easier than I thought to become a Captain Cook just by accident. I didn't want to take beaches away from the locals, but every time I walked there, I was adding to the crowds. Every time I parked a car, I made it that much harder for someone else. Later that same day, on Kauai, we tried to order a pizza for dinner. Our daughter has a pretty restrictive diet, and pizza is one of the few things she will eat. But when we called to order, the voice at the other end told us no. And for a moment, we were confused. We can wait, Laura explained. No, said the voice at the other end. There are too many orders. We can't make any more. There were so many people on the island that the infrastructure built to serve them was just overwhelmed. And then later that same night, Jamie came to our room because she had just gotten a tsunami alert on her phone. There had been an 8.2 magnitude earthquake in Alaska, the biggest quake in the United States for about 50 years, and we should be ready to evacuate to higher ground if it went from a watch to a warning. And I thought of all the other people in all the resorts and hotels, all of them lining up their cars on the two narrow roads that headed inland. No tsunami came, but it really was too much. My run that morning had been intoxicating. I would hope that everyone at some point in their lives has the chance to feel that someday, to go afoot and lighthearted and take to the open road. It seems to me like it ought to be a human birthright. But where does that right end? By the end of the day, I was worried that I had overstepped its boundary just by being on Kauai in the summer of 2021. When do our rights to move freely about this earth bump up against the rights of people to claim some space as their own? And who gets to decide where that line is? In an ever more connected world, it's a question that I find myself asking more and more often. Chapter 2, Native and Invader. On the big island of Hawaii, we stayed in the town of Kona, renowned for its coffee and for the Men's Ironman World Championship Endurance Race. During the day, we walked across lava fields in scorching heat to find black sand beaches, and at night, back on the outskirts of town, a beautiful and mysterious chorus of voices came from the dark trees and shadowed foliage. The same two notes, over and over. Koki, koki, koki. It came from everywhere and nowhere. Clearly, it was some kind of animal, but whether it was a bird, a frog, an insect, a mammal, I couldn't say. And it was loud. Get close enough and you could feel your eardrums vibrating, but not for long. Anytime we stepped into the brush to investigate, the calls would stop, leaving us peering under leaves. I eventually asked some shop owner what the sound was, and they said, "Oh, you mean the kokis. They're little frogs." I played the call on my phone, and sure enough, that's exactly what it was. In hindsight, they sound so much like our little Vermont tree frog, the spring peeper. And then the shop owner added, "They weren't here when we were kids." How did a tree frog make its way across thousands of miles of open ocean? Answer, by hitching a ride on imported plants in the late 1980s. In less than 40 years, the koki frogs had taken over the big island of Hawaii. One 2009 impact study estimated populations of 91,000 frogs per hectare. That's 2 to 3 times the population densities in their native Puerto Rico, and among the highest known population for any amphibian in the world. This would be a story that we would hear over and over again. As a devoted plant nerd who had never really spent much time in the tropics, I sought out every arboretum and botanical garden I could find. And in Hawaii, there are so many amazing ones with the strangest, most beautiful plants. But are they really Hawaiian? Thousands upon thousands of species of plants were brought to Hawaii from all over the world, and in the lush tropical environment they were fruitful and multiplied. There are now far more plant species living in Hawaii that were introduced by humans than species living on the islands when the first people arrived 1,000 years ago. One would think that the line between who is native and what is native and who and what is from away would be clear, but the more time I spent in Hawaii, the less clear that distinction became. Even those plants that were there before the Polynesian wayfarers arrived had to come from somewhere. Coconuts may have floated in on the waves. Some plants arrived in the guts of windblown birds. But ultimately, no bird or beast is truly native to Hawaii. Everyone is an invader, from the banyan trees in the park to the pig served up at a luau. Every single plant, every single animal had to come from someplace else. The only thing that is truly native to Hawaii is the lava rock. And the same is true for Hawaii's people. People were constantly coming in to these islands. Take Chad, who worked on a boat tour out of Kona, who gave up his dream of being a Texas cattle farmer during the pandemic and bought a house there. Or how about the flame-haired Alaskan girl who moved to the Big Island to work on a vanilla farm? Or the Japanese couple who retired to Kona to run a hole-in-the-wall sushi restaurant? Or even our friend Jamie, our host who so generously shared her apartment with a cluttered family of four who was a psychiatrist who grew up in Connecticut. All of these people were legal residents and citizens of the islands. They voted and they paid their bills and they saw their dentist there, but in some ways, they all still seemed like guests who had just stayed a bit longer. Everyone had a story of how they arrived, but none of those stories could possibly compare with the story of the first Hawaiians. These ancient mariners somehow arrived from the Marquesas Islands 2,300 miles away on ocean-going rafts, navigating across the open ocean with only their knowledge of the stars and the currents, weathering storms through an ocean wilderness of such incredible vastness. It is hard to comprehend the audacity of it. But to get a sense, imagine heading out from Boston Harbor and without any communications or landmarks, landing exactly in Lisbon. It was truly one of the greatest feats of human exploration of all time. And just like all the arrivals before them, the first human Hawaiians disrupted the lives of the current inhabitants. They brought crops and chickens and pigs. They spread and were fruitful and multiplied. They reshaped the ecosystems of the islands completely. Hawaii's history complicated my simple ideas of what it means to be native to a place. As a plant ecologist by training, I'm used to thinking about the disruptions that a new species can have. But Hawaii also suggested another side to that story, because each new arrival brought more than just disruption. They also brought things that were new and wonderful. For the past two centuries, people from all around the Pacific Rim have been coming to these islands, fleeing unrest in their own countries, looking for fortunes, enlisting for work. Hawaii is the melting pot and salad bowl that the rest of the United States has often made claims to, but seldom lived up to. And oh my gosh, how beautiful it has become because of it. It's not uncommon for Hawaiian families to trace their ancestry and traditions to Korea and the mainland United States and other Polynesian islands, and to lineages that have been on the Hawaiian Islands since the days of Charlemagne. Simple conceptions of race and culture break down into this delightful ambiguity. Who is here first? The question really seems less important when your family includes them all. The fact that this has happened is due in no small part to a cultural peculiarity of the Hawaiians. The word aloha, the only Hawaiian word that most mainlanders might know, is not just a greeting. It is a spirit and expectation of welcoming, a fundamentally different orientation to building a society than the provincialism and the us versus them that is so familiar in most of the cultures I know. Now, I'm certainly an outsider looking in. I know my understanding of aloha is limited, and I don't want to overplay it or romanticize it, but it seems clear to me that the Hawaiians were less concerned with marrying a good Jewish or Greek or Irish or Italian girl, and a lot less concerned with maintaining some kind of religious or cultural purity. And I found myself wondering about what the rest of our country might be like if we decided to live with a little bit more aloha ourselves. But I also see a darker side to the spirit of welcoming. It has often been taken advantage of by plantation farmers and colonial powers and the crowds on the beaches. My heart goes out to the patient and generous people of this exceedingly beautiful place, who, with the advent of air travel, have come to share their backyard with the whole world. Where has all this welcoming gotten them? Are the latest invaders bringing something new and wonderful? Some contribution to this place to balance out the disruptions that they have inevitably caused? I don't know. What I do know is that the more time I spent there, the more aware I became that there was no way I could visit a place, any place, without affecting it. This went way beyond leave no trace, because we always leave traces. But even if we didn't, our just being somewhere changes it. What's a beautiful country to do? Should there be a limit to the aloha we extend? Consider three different approaches, all from Hawaii. On the far western end of the archipelago is the rugged island of Niihau. It is the property of a single Hawaiian family. Other than themselves, their guests, and a limited number of day tours, no outsiders are allowed. The 100 or so residents of the island have no telephone service, no power lines, no running water, no paved roads. Perhaps there are just some parts of the world that ought to be off limits to travelers and explorers. Places that we just shouldn't go, like the depths of the Amazon or the Andaman Islands, where the inhabitants still throw spears at approaching helicopters. On the other end of the spectrum is Waikiki Beach, that miracle of surf and sand on the south shore of Oahu that is the birthplace of surfing. It is lined with outrageous hotels, and the sand is covered by bronzing tourists. Everyone is welcome, and everyone comes, until you can barely walk and the waves can be so crowded with novice surfers that they sometimes surf right over each other. It is packed, but it is also kind of wonderful. It's beautiful that this place is open to all and that it works. It stays clean and peaceful, and people from all over the world have a wonderful time. Maybe it's good that there are places like that. But between these extremes, there is also a middle way. On the east coast of Oahu is another possibility. Hanauma Bay is one of the most spectacular coral reefs in the world, a place that would be quickly destroyed if it were merely open to the Waikiki crowds. People could have chosen to close off the reef at Hanauma Bay to all visitors. But instead, at Hanauma, Hawaiian residents can visit as they like. But visitors must sign up for a limited number of spots. First come, first served. You can't buy your way in just because you're rich. Once the limited number of slots are gone, you just have to wait. And before you can go down to the bay, you basically have to get a lesson on how to do it well. You have to learn and abide by the rules. You have to wear the right sunscreen. You have to know not to touch the fish. You have to be told not to touch the reef. You're told where the bounds are. And at 3:30 each day, they clear everyone out and they let the creatures of the reef rest. Perhaps this is the way we keep from loving a place to death. We could say, aloha, you are welcome. Please wait your turn. Being in Hawaii made me more aware of my own history and my own nativity in a way that almost nothing else ever has. I've lived my whole life in New England. My dad's family came from actual England, but they came like 400 years ago. My mom's family is French, from Quebec, but they came across the border more than 150 years ago looking for work in the mines and the mills. So far as I know, none of my ancestors are what you might call Native American, but I have no claim by which I could call any other place my home. And even the Abnaki, on whose ancestral land I am standing now, came from someplace else. In the 8,000-year history of human inhabitation of this place, there's no reason to assume that they lived here in one long, unbroken lineage either. Perhaps they joined or displaced a previous people whose name is lost to history. Given all this, my old stories about who was from a place and who was from away got pretty complicated. I mean, who gets to say that they belong anywhere in a world where everyone is an immigrant? When are we visitors? And when are we home? And who gets to decide if we are welcome? This has been the first part of an essay in two parts. Tune in next week when I attempt to answer some of the questions raised here and suss out if there really is a difference between travelers and tourists at all. I Heart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian Amaro Cribbs. Our website is iheartthispodcast.com. You can email me at ben@iheartthispodcast.com, and we're on Facebook at iheartthispodcast. Thank you so much for listening, and as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.